Section 3, Pivotal Political Changes. As you read, look for how population shifts and the civil rights movement led to legislative reapportionment, the rise of the Republican Party in South Carolina, the moderating influence of Governors Hollings, Russell, McNair, West, and Edwards, damage to the state's reputation by events involving civil rights and workers' rights, terms, urbanization, reapportionment, Southern strategy. The decades after 1960 were marked by the rise of a significant Republican Party in the state. This presented a new challenge to the century-old control of the Democratic Party. Urbanization and immigration. Shifting populations in the second half of the 20th century had a great impact on South Carolina's political development. Urbanization, the movement of the population from rural counties to cities, shifted the majority of voters to the urban areas. But the legislature remained largely in the hands of the old rural elite, who represented a dwindling percentage of the population. For example, each county still had one senator, whether it was Barnwell County, with 17,659 people in 1960, or Greenville County, with 209,776. The senator from Barnwell, as chair of the Finance Committee, had more raw political power than the governor. So did the representative from Barnwell, who was Speaker of the House. People spoke of the Barnwell ring dominating the state. Citizens living in or near cities had some different needs from rural residents. They needed streets, water and sewer systems, new schools, growth of job opportunities, and regulations on pollution. Urban dwellers became frustrated with their lack of influence in state government. A growing class of wealthy business elite, many from out of state, was particularly restless under the old leadership. The need for reapportionment, distributing representation according to population, was apparent. In 1964, the U.S. Supreme Court required states to give cities representation in proportion to their population. The court was trying to make each person's vote, whether from country or city, have equal influence in the legislature. This one-person, one-vote concept was an advance for democracy. However, urban counties elected their several representatives at large, all voters voting on all representatives. This made it difficult for black candidates to get elected in white-majority counties. In 1973, the NAACP won a court decision requiring that senators and representatives be elected from single-member districts roughly equal in population. Black leaders correctly calculated that more black candidates could be elected from single-member districts. Three blacks had been elected to the legislature in 1970, the first in the 20th century. The number of blacks elected increased considerably after 1973 as Democratic officials drew district lines to provide some black majority districts. It had unintended consequences, however. Many districts were made more white. This meant that districts without significant black population elected representatives who had no strong obligation to black citizens. Single-member districts also contributed to the election of more Republican candidates. For the first time since 1877, the Republican Party became a significant factor in South Carolina politics. The rise of the Republican Party. The Republican Party had become a shell after Reconstruction as the Democratic Party seized all political power in South Carolina. The Dixiecrat movement of Strom Thurmond in 1948 was the first crack in the Democratic monopoly. Governor James F. Burns remained a Democrat in name, but he strongly supported Republican presidential candidates Dwight D. Eisenhower in 1952 and Richard Nixon in 1960. A man of his prominence, defying the party, encouraged others who were discontented with the Democratic support for civil rights and union rights. In the late 1950s and 1960s, a few economically conservative businessmen and women began to take over leadership positions in the tiny Republican Party and to build it into a positive force in the state. J. Drake Edens, Jr. became the state chairman in the early 60s and quietly put together a modern political party. The party attracted voters from three main sources. The first source was the many people who moved in from northern states, either to run the southern branches of an industry or to retire in a sunnier climate. Often they had Republican roots in their home states. Second was the wave of young, college-educated, ambitious business and professional people who filled the suburbs. They were economic and social conservatives who leaned toward Republican policies, but waited for it to be more socially acceptable before openly becoming Republicans. The third source of new Republicans was the large number of Carolinians who supported the tradition of white supremacy. They were opposed to the liberal racial policies of the National Democratic Party. The event that made shifting to the Republican Party respectable in South Carolina was the election of 1964. Here was a clear choice. Lyndon Johnson, a Democrat, had become president when John F. Kennedy was assassinated. He persuaded Congress to pass the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The Republicans nominated Senator Barry Goldwater of Arizona, who was strongly opposed to the act and what he saw as a shift toward too much federal power and too few states' rights. Senator Strom Thurmond jumped to the Republican Party to support Goldwater, and suddenly it was respectable to be a Republican in South Carolina. Goldwater was the first Republican presidential candidate to carry South Carolina since Reconstruction, but he lost in the nation. Thurmond was reelected in 1966, this time as a Republican, and helped other Republican candidates run strong races. 23 Republicans won seats in the General Assembly. South Carolina quickly became a reliable state for Republicans in presidential elections. The Southern strategy devised by Goldwater's 1964 campaign was refined by Senator Thurmond and his assistant, Harry Dent, in Richard Nixon's 1968 campaign. It would be used to win every presidential election for the Republicans from 1968 through 1988, with the exception of Democrat Jimmy Carter's win in 1976. The promises of the Southern strategy, along with the long-held Republican pro-business and anti-union policies, were popular with many white Southerners. They were to create a solid Republican South on which Republican national victories could be built. It took longer to gain control of state and local governments. Democrats would control the legislature and most local governments until the 1990s. Moderate governors. Compared to several other southern states, South Carolina was fortunate to have a string of moderate governors beginning in 1959. Though conservative on fiscal, financial, and most social issues, they tended to be far-sighted and realized that change was coming whether the state was ready or not. The black population was unwilling to accept many of the restrictions of the past. The populations moving from the farms to the towns and cities wanted jobs in industry and commerce. Business people moving to our state insisted on stable race relations, better education for their children, and more highly trained workers. The moderate governors valued order even more than racial segregation. Their priorities were economic development and improved education. Ernest F. Hollings. Elected governor at age 36, Ernest F. Fritz Hollings played a major role in improving South Carolina's chances to increase economic development. He increased the work of the State Development Board. He was able to work with the rural leadership in the General Assembly, especially Senator Edgar Allan Brown and House Speaker Solomon Blott, both of Barnwell County. Hollings convinced the legislators to create the technical education system, to improve teachers' salaries significantly, and to establish South Carolina Educational Television, SCETV. Soon, SCETV was providing closed-circuit educational programs to schools in all 46 counties. It also opened several open-circuit stations to broadcast non-commercial programs. SCETV and SCETV Radio have become very important parts of our cultural life. In 1966, Hollings was elected to the U.S. Senate, where he served until his retirement in 2005. Donald S. Russell. Governor Donald S. Russell continued Hollings' moderate leadership. On his inauguration day in January 1963, he invited all the people to a barbecue on the spacious lawn of the governor's mansion. About 8,000 people came to the party. Russell sent the state's law enforcers to Clemson to make sure Harvey Gantt was able to enter peacefully as its first black student. He was governor barely 2 years when U.S. Senator Allen D. Johnston died. The governor had to appoint a person to serve until the next general election. Russell resigned as governor. Lieutenant Governor Robert E. McNair became governor and appointed Russell to the Senate seat. This self-appointment was used against him in the election in 1966, and Russell lost the Senate race to Ernest F. Hollings. Russell's judgment in virtually appointing himself senator might have been questionable, but he spent the last 31 years of his life as a distinguished federal judge. Robert E. McNair. Robert E. McNair served the remainder of Russell's term as governor and then was elected for a full term in 1966. He continued Hollings and Russell's relatively moderate position on civil rights. McNair was governor during the years of greatest racial change in South Carolina schools. Under his guidance and with persistent pressure from NAACP lawyers and the federal government, the school system made the transition from freedom of choice to a real unitary system in 1970 and 1971. There were small incidents of violence related to the schools in those years. The most serious violent outbreak related to the public schools was by angry white parents in Lamar protesting court-ordered integration in 1970. Wielding bricks and axe handles, nearly 200 men and women attacked two school buses, showering the black children with glass. The students barely escaped into the school before the protesters overturned two buses. Highway patrolmen and SLED agents suppressed the mob with tear gas and arrested 40 people. Three received jail sentences. Governor McNair dispatched the National Guard to maintain order in the community. The Orangeburg Massacre. The Orangeburg Massacre was the major South Carolina tragedy in the civil rights era. The white people of Orangeburg were among the last in the South to accept federal laws requiring equal rights for blacks. In 1968, 4 years after the Civil Rights Act passed, some businesses were still closed to blacks. Students at State College and Claflin College began several nights of mass protest against the only bowling alley in town. Governor McNair sent several dozen highway patrolmen and National Guardsmen to the town to help maintain order. On February 8, 1968, a large number of students gathered on one corner of State College campus and built a bonfire. A fire truck arrived, and highway patrolmen moved up to the edge of the campus. One lawman was hit in the face by an object thrown by a student. Minutes later, officers began firing at the unarmed students. When the shooting ended, less than 10 seconds later, three students lay dying and about 27 lay wounded. Nothing like this had happened before on an American campus. 9 patrolmen were tried on federal charges for their part in what appeared an unwarranted action. They were acquitted by a South Carolina jury. The only person punished was one of the wounded men. Cleveland Sellers was convicted of inciting a riot at an earlier protest at the bowling alley. He served 7 months in prison. Sellers later earned his doctorate, taught African American studies at USC, and then became president of Voorhees College in his hometown of Denmark. Governor McNair, in his farewell address, called the shooting at Orangeburg a scar on our state's conscience. The Charleston Hospital Workers' Strike. In 1969, black hospital workers in 2 Charleston hospitals formed a union to bargain for their rights, wages equal to whites, and rehiring of fired workers. When hospital officials refused to bargain with the union, 400 workers went on strike for 100 days. During that time, the city was in turmoil. Thousands of people engaged in hundreds of demonstrations. Governor McNair imposed a curfew and sent in hundreds of National Guardsmen. 800 people were arrested during the ordeal. National union leaders, the SCLC, and Coretta Scott King, widow of Dr. Martin Luther King, got involved, calling attention to the civil rights issues at stake. The strike was national news, and Charleston's tourist economy and its reputation suffered. The governor was sympathetic to the economic demands of the strikers, but was absolutely opposed to recognizing their union or allowing it to bargain for the workers. The strike was finally settled by a compromise. The hospitals agreed to rehire any fired workers, raise wages, and set up a grievance process to handle workers' complaints. The hospitals did not agree to allow unions to represent workers' interest, but the workers felt they had gained a degree of respect. John C. West. The power of the new moderation in South Carolina politics was demonstrated in the election of John C. West as governor in 1970. The campaign that year was the last one in which race was the major issue. West accepted, even embraced, most of the changes that had reshaped the state in the 1960s. His opponent, Republican Congressman Albert Watson, called on the people to resist school integration and the illegal court decisions requiring it. West's victory demonstrated that racism was no longer a winning strategy in South Carolina politics. The victory also showed the power of the new black voters who were added to the electorate after the Voting Rights Act of 1965. West received a large percentage of those votes. He also received the votes of many white suburban Republicans who did not favor Watson's open appeal to racism. As governor, John West worked to improve race relations. He appointed blacks to key staff positions. He established the Commission on Human Affairs to head off any such crises as the Orangeburg bowling clash and the Charleston hospital strike. His administration showed great concern about problems of poverty, health, and the environment. He also followed the lead of Hollings and McNair in vigorously pursuing investors from out of state to bring more economic development into South Carolina. They believed many of the state's problems could be solved with more job opportunities, higher income, and a more diverse economy. Governor West was in charge of a major overhaul of the Constitution of 1895. Tilghman's Constitution was cumbersome, unsuited for 20th century conditions, and in violation of new federal court decisions. The Constitution became more streamlined, more modern, and workable. The constitutional changes and the court decision requiring single-member districts in the legislature made it more difficult for the old rural elite to control the government. By the mid-1970s, the more heavily populated urban areas had their opportunity to dominate. James B. Edwards. The election of the first Republican governor of South Carolina since Reconstruction was a surprise to many people, including the Republican candidate James B. Edwards himself. though he won against a divided Democratic Party, Edwards' election was still an important step in the growth of a two-party system. He turned out to be a moderate, especially on the issue of race. An oral surgeon by training, and with only 2 years of service in the South Carolina Senate, Edwards had to muster all his social skills and likable personality to deal effectively with a heavily Democratic legislature. The constitutional amendments of West's term had not increased the powers of the governor. The legislature was still in charge. Edwards advocated keeping government expenses low. A major accomplishment of his term in office was passage of the Education Finance Act, a landmark effort to equalize spending for education across the state. The idea was for the state to provide more funds for schools in poor districts where not much local revenue was available, and to provide less money to rich districts where local revenue was abundant. It was a noble goal, and the law has been very useful, but the state has not yet solved the problem of unequal educational opportunities in various parts of the state. Do you remember? 1. Define in sentence form, urbanization, reapportionment, southern strategy. 2. When was the State Development Board created, and what was its mission? 3. Where did the new South Carolina Republican Party of the 1950s and 1960s get its members? The following is a summary of Chapter 15. South Carolinians witnessed major changes during the decades of the 1960s and 1970s. The most notable changes were in the area of civil rights. The days of the signs "Coloreds Only" and "Whites Only" were to be a thing of the past. The beginnings of equality for the races were on the horizon. That brought the hope of a better future to parents whose children would experience that change for the better. The United States government responded to civil rights issues by passing legislation protecting the rights of African American citizens to vote and by outlawing discrimination in the workplace. These advances did not come easily and resulted in violence far too often. People remember the names of slain leaders such as Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., but there were many others, both black and white, who lost their lives fighting for equality for all Americans. Civil rights was not the only issue of these decades, as Americans watched the first televised war going on in Vietnam on the other side of the world. Protest against U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War resulted in violence at times, even as students shouted, "Peace, not war." Even women were becoming active in the push for equal rights.